We need a real investigation. I don't think we have one yet.
Yes, it's true. And yes, it is a crime.
Well, thank you, Cleta Mitchell. Thank you for that explanation. Really interesting and kind of appalling.
Thank you,
really.
Tucker.
Cleta Mitchell is somebody with great courage, and she's involved with your litigation and lawsuits and all of this stuff. She literally gave up her whole practice not to get paid. She saw how corrupt it was, how disgusting it was, how dirty it was. And I want to thank you on behalf of everybody in this room and everybody in this country. You are a hell of a lawyer and tough. And that's what we need.
Hello, I'm Cleta Mitchell. I'm the senior legal fellow at the Conservative Partnership Institute in charge of the Election Integrity Network. You can learn more about the Election Integrity Network by visiting our website, www.whoscounting.us. That's www.whoscounting.us. Subscribe to our podcast, sign up for the newsletter, and join our Election Integrity Network. Who's Counting is a podcast about America's elections, all about voting, about how our elections are supposed to work, about how they don't work sometimes, about how they do work, about what you can do, about how the left has infiltrated election offices throughout the country, and how elections really work for citizens and why citizens need to get involved. We talk in this podcast with people and experts and engaged citizens who can tell us about what happened in 2020, who can tell us about what's happening in 2021, and most importantly, what needs to happen for 2022 and how we as Americans must get involved to retake our election systems and be in charge of our election systems. Remember that this is all about saving our republic. You will remember when the story about how when Ben Franklin left the Constitutional Convention, a woman asked him outside, "Dr. Franklin, what sort of government have you given us?" And Dr. Franklin looked at her and said, "A republic, madam, if you can keep it." And that's what this podcast is about. It's about keeping our republic. The left has understood for a very long time that if they can change the political process, including elections, that they can change the policy outcomes. And that is what we are witnessing today. We are seeing the progressive left's vision of America coming to fruition through the Congress and through this administration because of what they did in 2020, whether it is open borders and the chaos there, whether it is the collapse of Afghanistan and the utter humiliation and surrender of America in Afghanistan, whether it's inflation or the brainwashing of our children with critical race theory, and on and on and on. It is a product, it's a policy product of the 2020 election. And the left has also understood, and they've been able to engage literally tens of dozens of wealthy billionaire, fat cat leftist liberal donors who have invested, I would say, hundreds of millions of dollars, perhaps billions of dollars for more than a decade in building an infrastructure to control our elections. So this podcast is all about how we can do something about that. What do we need to know about that? And so we welcome you to subscribe to the podcast, whoscounting.us, go to our website and participate with us as we move forward toward 2022 and trying to reclaim our country and save our republic. And in that regard, we are thrilled today to welcome my good friend, J. Kenneth Blackwell, who has had and continues to have a most distinguished career. Ken and I have been friends and colleagues in this battle for many years. I'm so honored that you would be with us today. Ken is the former mayor of Cincinnati, Ohio. He is the former state treasurer of Ohio. He's the former secretary of state of Ohio. And Ken, I just am so thrilled that you would join the conversation with me today to talk about elections and who's counting. So welcome.
Cleta, it's good to be with you. You have framed this most appropriately. We are in our 245th year as a nation, and our experiment in self-governance is being threatened by mighty forces on the left. And you know, the human condition is not a spectator sport. You can choose to be on the front lines or on the sidelines. But as they say, you choose to act or be acted upon. And so I'm delighted to be in the trenches with you as we fight back.
Well, Ken, you know, you've had so many high-level positions, and I consider your highest-level position being married to Rosa, your wonderful wife, who was a school administrator, I think, by the time she retired. I guess she was a school teacher and
superintendent.
Mm-hmm. And you have three children and grandchildren.
Yes.
And, but I also think that one of your greatest contributions is your serving as such a key linchpin in the conservative movement. You wear a lot of hats and you knit groups and people together. And I just want to publicly thank you for what you do by lending your prestige and your influence and your knowledge and experience to so many different organizations. It's really gratifying to me. I really appreciate that.
But again, it's good to be in the trenches with, with you and others fighting a good fight. Because it is a time for choosing. Martin Luther King, back in the mid-60s, wrote a book, Chaos or Community, a time for choosing. And this is such a time as that was, a time for choosing. Do we choose the narrative that is being promoted by the 1619 New York Times Project? Or do we realize that in 1776, we became a guiding force for freedom. You and I have talked about this many times. Aristotle probably framed it early on in Western civilization when he said that there is a dynamic tension between the organized power of the state and individual liberty. The more muscular, the more powerful the state, the less individual liberty we have. And so the framers of our Constitution, they put a harness on the reach and muscularity of the state to give us optimum individual liberty. And they understood that it wasn't about big government guiding our lives. It's about individual choices. And they recognized that the family was the incubator mm-hmm. of liberty. And whether it is in my capacity as a former diplomat traveling the globe, one of the things that I know about the history of statist forms of government is that they try to crush the family. They try to build dependency. And as you and I have worked and talked before, what happened in 1776, the framers of our Constitution and the founders, they in fact wanted to make sure that we were free-willed citizens, not subjects of the state, to be manipulated and messed around with by a bureaucratic elite. And so crush the family, run God and faith out of the public square. That's at the heart of elitist forms of government. And one of the things that they do to cement that, as we're experiencing today, is that they will, in fact, try to centralize power in government, particularly government that they would desire to be run by one party, mm-hmm. and take the power to influence elections away from localities, away from communities, and crush us and make us subjects.
Well, you know, you mentioned your role as an ambassador. You were the UN ambassador to the UN Commission on Human Rights.
Human Rights.
And you're also been a longtime board member of the International Foundation for Electoral Systems. Talk about a little bit more about what you learned from that, and what are the lessons that you would share with our audience about what we have to be worried about. You've talked about it just brilliantly there, but why do they think that that's the preferable way for a country to run? What is that about?
Well, they don't believe in self-governance. Mm. They are enemies of individual liberty. And so one of the things that they fret over the most is found in that second paragraph of the Declaration of Independence. We hold these truths to be self-evident, which my dad used to say was a highfalutin way of saying any knucklehead should be able to get this. that we're all created equal, that we're endowed by our creator with certain unalienable rights, which means that our fundamental rights are not grants from government like the left believes.
They do believe that. They really do believe that.
They're gifts from God. And therefore, there is a clash of worldviews. And this is a frontal attack on America's self-governance. And so what we know, you and I talk in technical terms about elections, but we know that if you, in fact, have a tight chain of custody, that you make it difficult for fraud, for irregularities, if, in fact, you have verification systems that make sure that people are who they claim to be, what you have is a system that builds confidence in the results. And therefore, this attack on the chain of custody, this attack on verification, common sense verification processes and policies like voter ID, you know, it is the ammunition of the enemies of individual liberty and self-governance.
Well, I want to go back to how I want you to talk about your upbringing. And we were talking before we started about our both being teenagers during the time when the Voting Rights Act was adopted in the mid-60s. And I wanted you to talk about your upbringing and your family. I just finished reading Jason Riley's book about Dr. Thomas Sowell. Such a fascinating, wonderful book. But, you know, there have been Black intellectuals for 100 years who have said, who've rejected some of these notions that we're seeing today. But how did you come to your beliefs? Because it can't be easy for you. It cannot be easy for you, but you have a strong character and you're big. So, yeah, you're a former football player, right? So talk about your upbringing. And I've listened a little bit about the podcast about your uncle and the Olympics. But talk about your upbringing.
Well, you know, one, I grew up in a working class family. My dad was a veteran of World War II. My mom was a high school dropout who was an avid reader who went back to school and got her GED and was a practical nurse. But first and foremost, she was a mom because they really did believe that the family was the incubator of liberty. But you know, my uncle D. Hart Hubbard was the first Black American to win an Olympic gold medal.
Wow.
In a track and field event, in an individual track and field event.
And what year was that?
That was 1924. And in 1924, he set the world record in the long jump. But what my family remembers most was that he had qualified to run in the 100-yard dash and the higher hurdles. And he had a transatlantic debate with Eric Little, of Chariots of Fire fame.
Oh, wow.
And they were going to determine in Paris, who was the fastest man on the face of the earth. And when he got to Paris, the International Olympic Committee told him that the 100-yard dash and the high hurdles were white-only events.
Oh, my gracious.
And so he couldn't compete. But as you remember, Eric Little chose not to compete because the final race fell on a Sunday, and he practiced the Sabbath. So my uncle came back and he told her family that God had blessed him, that God had, in fact, given him the opportunity to set the world record in the long jump. Let me say parenthetically, he set the world record in the 100 the following year. But in Nazareth, he said he was able to witness a fidelity to faith that became his guidepost throughout life. And so that is why, whether, you know, my family believed what Lincoln said, that America was not perfect, but it was perfectible, and it was made better by folks who had united sense of purpose mm-hmm. that moved history forward. History is a process. It is not a snapshot. You can't be frozen in this moment. So the New York Times that are frozen in 1619, that's their problem because they sort of cancel out 245 years of history of how America has gotten better. Nobody denies that in the 40s, the 30s, the 40s, the 50s, and the 60s, there was racial discrimination and there was exclusion based on race. You know, but nobody should deny that this is not 1960 or 1965. This is 2021. And the reality is that there has been a lot of progress. And people are breaking the rules of law to get in here.
That's
nobody's
true.
Breaking the rules of law to get out of here. That's you true. Know, and
that may change if they don't change, if we had a place to go.
And that is what is so and to me insulting.
Yeah.
About the present charge of the left, that people who want to protect the integrity of our voting process mm-hmm. somehow are throwback to, you know, to Jim Crow. Just think about this, Cleta. When my uncle came back, he had graduated from the University of Michigan. He, in fact, the best job he could get was a playground director associate director of the Cincinnati Recreation Department. So he expanded Knott Hope Baseball into the mm-hmm. black communities of Cincinnati, was the founder of the Cincinnati Tigers and one of the founders of the American Negro Baseball League. You know, and so Satchel Paige played in that league and was a friend of my uncle's. And Satchel Paige used to always say, you know, he said two things that stuck with me. He said, why are you looking back? You're not moving in that direction. You know, and the other thing he said, it's real difficult to steal second base if you want to keep one foot on first.
Right.
And so my uncle and my family always thought you had to make a break for liberty. You mm-hmm. couldn't keep your foot stuck in the status quo. You had to engage, but we had to engage together. And so going back, you know, just understanding that my family realized, whether it was in Chattanooga, Tennessee, or Clarksdale, Mississippi, that progress was made when we were choosing community over chaos. That's what is so disturbing today.
And that was Martin Luther King's phrase.
That's right.
Phrase,
that's right.
That was his concept.
That's right. That's right. Choosing community. Oh, and we used to always say, community is not uniformity. That means that, you know, there's brilliance in our diversity, but we have something that holds us together. And that is a fundamental belief in individual liberty and self-governance.
Well, you know, one of the things that I have not understood, and maybe you can explain this if it is a subject explanation, but Black Lives Matter, I understand now they've scrubbed their website, but one of the basic tenets of Black Lives Matter is destruction of the family unit. And I do not understand how what we've witnessed is the destruction of Black families since the 60s mm-hmm. and the Great Society programs. And to the idea, well, let's make everybody dependent. And how can these corporations give hundreds of millions of dollars to Black Lives Matter when they want to destroy the family, and they want us to be a Marxist society? I just don't understand
it. But you've nailed it. The leadership of Black Lives Matter had on their website that they embraced Marxism.
Right.
You know, and if you from Marx to Mao, the destruction of the family has been part of the prescription to build dependency on the state. And so the welfare programs of the 60s, the 70s, the 80s, you know, those programs destroyed the family. Mm-hmm. If you stop to think about it, they discouraged families from staying together and struggling through periods of low income. And so, and to get a welfare payment, the family had to split up. And so this is just part of, you know, the status model. What, again, whether it was Marx or Mao.
Or Black Lives Matter.
Or Black Lives Matter. Mm-hmm. They, in fact, wanted to destroy the family, and they wanted to drive God and faith out of the public square. And they do not want local control of elections. They want it in the hands of a bureaucratic state. In this case, the administrative state, actually controlled, they would hope, by radical leftist Democrats and the Biden administration. But I tell them what, let me tell you what I tell them. Look at what that's going to get you. You know, right now, hyperinflation, crime-ridden cities. You just look at it, critical race.
Energy dependence instead of independence.
That's right. You know, the critical race theory, you know, which is nothing more than state-sponsored racism. Mm-hmm. You know, and so we're pushing back, and because we know that the human condition is in a spectator sport, and it's not a place for sideline sitters. You know, you have to demand a recognition of your right to self-governance and individual liberty.
So, Ken, you were the Secretary of State in 2004 when Bush was up for re-election. And I've always said that something snapped with the American left when Bush was re-elected in 2004. It was after that the Democracy Alliance was built, and then from that spawned all of these, you know, massively well-funded, you know, billions of dollars given to all these left-wing things, and their stated goal to, you know, George Soros was one of the original founders, but he's certainly not alone.
Right.
But tell us about 2004 in Ohio when you were the Secretary of State. I really think, frankly, Ken, that it's because of you that the George Soros started the Secretary of State project.
Yes.
And started all these things. But talk to us about what happened in 2004 when they were so intent. I really believe they had planned to make Ohio
the battleground state,
and mm-hmm. they were going to make it the Florida of 2004, just like Florida mm-hmm. been in 2000. Mm-hmm. And they started upending election laws that principles that have been in place forever. I can say that as an election lawyer, I was shocked to see these things happening after the election in 2000. But talk to us about what happened in 2004. What was it like in Ohio? What happened in Hamilton County? Right. Talk about that.
Well, you know, this is to me, it's fascinating because our system was a system that was strictly bipartisan. Mm-hmm. We have 88 counties. There are boards of elections in those 88 mm-hmm. counties, two Democrats, two Republicans, and it takes three to get something done out of those.
So they had to
the
work
four.
Together.
They had to work together. And so, so what happened in 2004, Bush won the state by about 118,000 votes. And that was a broader spread than they had anticipated. But there were a couple of things. In Ohio, the state legislature has said, for your vote to count, you must cast it in the precinct in which you were registered. So that means that in the county, you were not a voter without borders.
Right.
You know, there were well-defined rules for casting a ballot that would help us control the chain of custody and give us a great chance of making sure, verifying that a person is who he or she claimed to be. Well, sure enough, Kerry lost, and the left went berserk. And they started to spin narratives that were just made out of lies, made out of whole cloth. For instance, in Franklin County, where the state the city of Columbus okay. and the state capital mm-hmm. is located, they in fact said, "Look at those long lines."
Oh, that's where the long lines myth came from.
Oh, look! look at the long lines. Well, it really wasn't a myth. But what had happened was that the Kerry people had run a pretty interesting campaign. They talked, Ohio State was the largest university in the country. They talked those kids in not voting back in their home state.
Oh.
But voting.
Registering and voting in Ohio.
So look, voting machines are placed on patterns of participation in elections past.
Right.
You know, so people don't have an idea of when a rush is going to come. So the voting machines were placed in the precincts based on past voting patterns.
Based on the decisions of the local election board.
Not the state, but based on the county.
It was Franklin County.
And guess what? Guess who was the chairman of the Franklin County Board of Elections? It was a guy who was the vice president of a labor union and a Democrat Party leader in Franklin County. They made the decision under his direction, where to place those voting machines.
But
Al Sharpton, Jesse Jackson, and others on the left, they had to create a narrative that it was the position of the Secretary of State to deliberately misplace those voting machines to put an undue burden on Black voters, particularly in Columbus, to suppress the vote. Well, the reality was that year in 2000, four, because of some aggressive things that we had done, we had the highest Black turnout, not just in Franklin County, but in Ohio in the state's history.
They forgot that conveniently. They
conveniently forgot that. Just as today, you know, they talk about suppression of the Black vote, but they don't go back and take a look, you know, at 2020 and the Black turnout.
Mm-hmm.
You know, there wasn't anything suppressing about that election. And so anytime somebody asks for a mask, and the reason I was started to tell you about my uncle and baseball is because, you know, part of my family's legacy, I am now a shareholder of the Cincinnati Reds.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. And so I had the audacity to speak out when the commissioner decided that they were going to move the All-Star game, Major League Baseball All-Star game, from Atlanta to Denver, Colorado. And I basically said, well, why are we doing that? And that was because the Georgia reforms, which was anchored by voter ID, they said it was a throwback to Jim Crowism. So I asked a very basic question. If I was to leave for you tickets to come to a Cincinnati Reds game at the will call window, what would you have to show to pick up those those tickets? And look, I'm almost a 3 million miler with Delta. Can you imagine me going up to the window to ID myself, showing them my utility bill?
Or your bank statement.
You know, so this whole notion that somehow a common sense, free of charge, photo ID is a throwback. You know, they have lost it. They lost the majority of Americans. They've lost the majority of Black Americans with that sort of crazy charge.
Well, talk about that for a moment. I mean, you've seen the polling data. Tell our audience about what the polls show about these common sense election reforms.
Over 80% of Americans, all Americans, want it. Close to 70% of Black Americans want it.
Voter ID to vote.
It's common sense. You know, to take out a library book.
Yes.
You know, but at the end of the day, you know, it takes people pushing back. You just don't put your head in the sand. You just don't take this nonsense. We, in fact, you know, Frederick Douglass, the great abolitionist, said it best. He said, those who are whooped the easiest are whooped most often.
Oh, yeah.
And yeah. So, you know, we're just not going to take it. And the same crowd, you know, like I said, that's pushing critical race theory, you know, the same crowd that is, you know, advancing an open borders policy. I mean, we have become a nation without borders.
Yes, which means that you're not a nation anymore.
You're not a nation anymore. And it's the one world government folks who believe that it is wrong to demand citizenship and have requirements for citizenship. You know, here's the reality. Our border in the South being open, we've seen an increase, not just in so-called refugees or, mm-hmm. or aliens. We've seen an increase in drugs. Mm-hmm. We've seen an increase in human trafficking.
Of women and children.
And at the same time that these idiots are talking about defunding the police in our major cities, guess which communities are being hit hardest by this surge of drugs, illegal drugs? You know, it's the Chicago's, it's the Detroit's, it's the Cleveland's in this country. And so this is not just some academic exercise. This is impacting lives. This is killing our kids. You know, and look, the Biden administration and mm-hmm. the left pushing this nonsense from this federalization of elections to the open borders, these folks are responsible for this travesty. And what is happening? They are bleeding political capital. They're bleeding out. And we cannot, as concerned Americans of all stripes, we cannot let these clowns off the mat.
Well, you know, Ken, one of the things that worries me, and I wrote a piece about this on the 4th of July, because you referenced the first paragraph of the, or maybe the second paragraph of, mm-hmm. of the Declaration of Independence, in which it says that governments derive their just powers from the consent of the governed. And what I have worried about, what I worry about, is looking at what happened in 1994, when people were finally fed up with the Democrats and threw them out of office and put Republicans in the majority in the House and Senate for the first time in 40 years. And then it happened again in 2010 when the Democrats controlled everything and the people rose up and said no to Obamacare and the overreach and all. They crammed it down our throats anyway. But I'm worried that the left and the Democrats have looked at that data and said, we're going to do whatever we want to do, and we're going to fix the system. So matter how badly we screw up, and no matter how much the people disagree with us, we're going to fix the elections. So we put ourselves beyond the reach of the people, and therefore our ability to give and withdraw our consent. Do you think that's far-fetched?
No, it's not far-fetched. And again, it's part of the playbook. That these folks in that conversion from free-willed citizens to subjects, and one of the ways they do this is that they create a disincentive to working. When folks can make more income not working than working, you know, too many people choose not.
Which is what's happening now. You just drive down the street and see the hiring.
Yeah. And so what is happening is that whole conversion process, they've put it in overdrive because they can already sense that they're losing political capital and losing traction. And so that's why, you know, as we're talking now, they're building up for September offensive and we better be ready for it. They're going to come back and they're going to try to drive all of this election, so-called election reforms, which is in their term, in the real sense, what they're really looking to do is to federalize our elections, you know, take it out of the hands of state legislatures. Because what they realize mm-hmm. is that even though Republicans sometimes act like 90-pound weaklings, mm-hmm. we have more, we we control more state legislative chambers. We have more governorships. We have more county commissioners than they do.
Well, you know what? One of the things that's interesting about that is remember that Barack Obama and Eric Holder started a project after Eric Holder left office, and then Obama joined him in this project. And they raised and spent something like $400 million trying to flip state legislatures so that they could control redistricting after the census. And they did not flip a single state house.
Right.
Not one. I think maybe Republicans even picked up some chambers. But now, because they lost that ability to control redistricting in the state legislatures, now these bills that they're introducing would take the decision out of the state legislatures. And first it was to put it into, quote, independent commissions, which are, we know, not independent, and then to put it in the hands of the Justice Department to say, Mother, may I, can this congressional district stand?
Because what they will do is play games and with this sort of universal preclearance process, you know, it's just crazy. I don't understand why while Republicans let these folks off the map or don't finish the job. I mean, to give them the cloak of bipartisanship over that
monstrosity, infrastructure. Yeah,
that's right.
FAUS.
Yeah, I would never get my brains wrapped around. So look, I think it's important that we do what many of us do. We build capacity at the local level. We feed off of the energy of people saying we're not going to take it anymore.
Right.
Whether it's their resistance to mass mandates, their resistance to critical race theory, where their children are just like re-education schools.
Maoist re-education camps. Believe me,
right.
I was in a big law firm, and I finally said, "I'm not going anymore of these Maoist re-education camps."
Right. So you know, that's why it's so important that we fight back, that we push back, that we understand. Again, I repeat. History is not a snapshot. It is a process. We have the God-given human agency to affect change, you know, and this is a time for choosing, mm-hmm. you know, choose to act or get acted upon.
Well, you know, in speaking about the Reverend Dr. Martin Luther King, we're coming upon the anniversary of his I Have a Dream speech at the Lincoln Memorial. I was a teenager. I was babysitting for the summer. My mother made me start working when I was 13, which is probably I'm not going to have a teenager lying around the house. Okay, so I was a professional babysitter. And I'll never forget watching that in Oklahoma City in the hot August day on my black and white, my neighbor's black and white television. I was babysitting their kids. And that was such a meaningful speech to me as a young girl in Oklahoma City. And it always has meant so much to me. And particularly when he said, you know, I have a dream that someday my little girls will be judged on the content of their character and not the color of their skin. It makes me cry just to think about it. But how have we gotten away from that? And what can we do to reclaim his vision of that?
First, we have to realize that those fundamental human rights are universal, and that they are not handed out based on skin color or mm-hmm. or ethnicity. They are truly gifts from God, and there's really, you know, we all of the, in my religious belief, we're all of one blood, mm-hmm. you know, and that is what matters. But we have to realize that there have been points in this country's 245 years mm-hmm. where things haven't been perfect, but we've made them better, and that's why it is so important. You talk about 1965; there might have been five blacks. You know, in Congress in 2021, they're what, 59?
I have some numbers here. We black turnout increased 14% just between 2016 and 2020. Black House members in 1965, there were five and no senators. And in 2021, we have 59 Black House members and three Black senators. And there are Black leaders and mayors, officials, mayors of every major city practically in the country.
Yeah, and look, you just think about it. This is one of the things, as a former mayor, I understand something about one, and a former treasurer, I understand about capital, and I understand about people vote with their feet when they can. And so you see migration patterns from high tax states to low tax states, from high crime ridden states and cities to low crime ridden states and cities. People vote their interest when they can move. We're mobile. Yes. We're mobile people. The other reality is that capital is a coward. Capital flees violence and disruption. And so if you begin to look at Chicago and
San Francisco and this closing of the stores in San Francisco.
But all of these major cities that are controlled by Democrats, you know, and in many of them are led by Black Democrats. You know, one of the things that we see is that, one, they were also in the forefront of defunding the police. Yeah. Safety is a fundamental responsibility of all levels of government.
That's right.
Government. And so, you know, just making people less safe will also make them less poor, because capital will leave. And what I know is that Republicans, you know, you can't replace something with nothing.
That's true.
We have to speak out. We have to provide an alternative. And that's the one thing that they don't want us to realize.
Yeah.
Actually, Trump in 2016 had double what Bush and Kerry had gotten in their respective presidential election. Bush.
Romney
and McCain.
Right.
You know, and he, this time around, he moved right next to George Bush when George had 11% of the Black vote. The reality is that Trump did not make his appeal to Black voters at 4 years, you know, just happening every 4 years. He stayed engaged. And as a consequence, folks saw their incomes go up, their job opportunities go up, better advocacy for school choice. He had upped the number of the dollars going to historic Black colleges and universities, and it paid dividends.
But we can't stop. We have to keep going to the Black communities.
We really do. We have to show up all the time, make our case. We don't have to have giveaway programs. We just have to have opportunity programs.
You know, I don't know. I don't know if we've ever even talked about this, but after the 1964 Civil Rights Act was passed, Oklahoma, under a Republican governor, became the first state to pass a state anti-discrimination act. And the first executive director of that agency was a retired Black Air Force major, William Y. Rose. And I worked my way through law school working for Major Rose, and I was the only white person in the office. And I actually learned so much from him and was one of the speakers at his funeral. But, you know, he gave me a job. I needed a job in law school, and I had stopped by to say hello to him because I knew him. And he said, "What are you doing at the Capitol?" And I said, "Well, I was looking for a job." He said, "Well, come work for me." And I worked half time there. And he taught me, and we would go give speeches together about how affirmative action. Now, this is in the early 70s. Mm-hmm. Affirmative action did not mean that you got a guaranteed job. It meant that employers had to take affirmative steps to give opportunities.
Right.
And anyway, but that was I grew up, my mother, you know, always said, "I'll slap you silly if I ever hear you use the N-word." Mm-hmm. You know, that is, and even if you hear your relatives say that, we don't use that in our house.
Mm-hmm.
And she taught us all. Yeah. All of us are God's children.
Yep.
You know, Jesus loves all the little children of the world, red and yellow, black and white. I mean, that's what I grew up with. And I just, I just hate that this whole idea of election integrity and voting rights are somehow it's become a racial issue. And I just don't believe it is. I think that that's something that's being fostered by a few left wingers and the media and the elites, but that the vast majority of the American people don't agree with.
All you do is look at the numbers, look at the metrics. Everything has been moving in a very positive direction mm-hmm. in terms of participation, in terms of elective office held by folks of different races and ethnicities. You know, to me, it goes in 245 years, America has become the most diverse, the most prosperous constitutional republic in all of human history. And we, in fact, don't have any apologies that we need to make for that. We start out with the reality, as Lincoln said, we're not perfect, but when we choose community, we get things done.
Well, Ken, let me ask you to tell us what you think are the two or three things that you would tell people to do, and tell us about your new Center for Election Integrity that you're working on with America First Policy Institute.
Well, one of the things is citizen engagement. We encourage folks to get off the sidelines, get on the front line of this battle. So one of the things, Cleta, you and I talk about is that we have too many vacancies in poll working positions across the country.
That's true.
And so we have to encourage and educate folks how to be effective poll workers, not poll watchers, not poll observers, but poll workers.
People, count the ballots.
People working at the precinct level. That gives us sets of eyeballs and transparency. That also gives us a sense of making sure that people are taking a stance for self-governance. They're not being pushed into this docile subject status, you know, of the activists on the left, and so we need to know what our challenges are. In Ohio, I think the mean age of a poll worker is 67 years old.
Wow.
Which means that we have to go out and recruit the next generation. People have to understand and value citizenship and understand what that means, and it means, you know, not only making sure that it's easy to vote, but as you and I and others have said, make it hard to cheat. The Center for Election Integrity is a partner with the other groups that have had
Like the Election Integrity Network,
that's right.
CPI.
Absolutely.
And the Public Interest Legal Foundation.
That's right. We are putting on our jersey, buttoning up our helmet, you know, and digging in.
And joining the team.
That's right. And we're running forward.
That's great. Ken, where can people, what's the best place? I think I saw today for the first time a website. Have you just unveiled a website, kenblackwell.com?
Kenblackwell.com. We've been bringing it along slowly.
It's just great. So if people want to know what you're up to, you are a prolific writer and author. So would that be the best
place to go?
Kenblackwell.com?
Yeah, absolutely.
Ken, I could speak for hours and hours with you. You're such a hero of mine. I once agreed to testify before a House Judiciary Committee because I read the lineup after they asked me, and I realized it was going to be beat up on Ken Blackwell Day. And that was, and I was there to defend you. And I remember that was the first time I ever saw Debbie Wasserman Schultz, and she was a witch, and she was standing there pointing at you. And anyways, awful. She was awful. But you are a true statesman, you're a fine man and a wonderful friend and a true patriot. And I really appreciate your being with us today.
Right back at you, Cleta.
That concludes this episode of Who's Counting. I hope that you will all join us regularly by subscribing to Who's Counting. Go to our website, whoscounting.us. That's whoscounting.us. Sign up, be part of the Election Integrity Network. Sign up for our newsletter, sign up for the podcast, and get off the sidelines and onto the front lines. Become engaged as citizens as we fight to regain control of our elections in these United States of America. God bless you and goodbye. Thank you for listening to Who's Counting? The Who's Counting podcast is produced by the Conservative Partnership Institute's Election Integrity Network. It is filmed and recorded at CPI Studios in Washington, D.C. Editing is by Creative Patriots. Please help us grow this podcast by sharing this episode with a friend. We rely on your word of mouth to get the word out because big tech can't be trusted, they try to cancel us daily, and they don't want us talking on social media about election fraud. Help fight back by visiting our website, www.whoscounting.us, and sign up for our election integrity newsletter, subscribe to our podcast, and get the real election integrity news.